Good morning, church. It's good to see you. Good to be with you all, as always. And loved our times of worship and gathering here with the Forest Mill family. I tell you, my family's not able to be with me today. They went. They've gone to church with my parents this morning. Their congregation, the Hillsboro Church of Christ, has a special guest speaker who's going to be talking about Christian evidences. So they wanted to hear better preaching. That's what I took away from their absence. Anyway, I hope that you had a great holiday season with your family and loved ones. We kind of are gotten through that now. I know that me and my family were blessed by that time and by the amazing food that we've had over the last few weeks. And now, with eyes on the new year, we're getting back into a more moderate routine, at least most people are, and people are starting to think about cutting back, right? Cutting back on spending, cutting back on eating, kind of getting back into some moderation, which is a good thing. And over the past few years, I've had several people ask me on multiple occasions about the spiritual discipline of fasting. Last week we talked about feasting, when Jesus went and sat down and ate with the tax collectors and the sinners. This week, we turn our questions to fasting. And, of course, many people use fasting just as a way to try to lose some weight or try to reset their bodies or purge toxins. I don't even know what all goes into it. But there are some physical benefits to fasting. And I know some people have asked just for those reasons. But some people really wanted to know if there was any spiritual benefit to fasting or whether we as Christians ought to be fasting, whether we ought to be partaking in fast, and those are some valid questions. In Jesus' day, fasting was part and parcel with spiritual redemption culture, right? There were a lot of people who were fasting, and the more religious you were, the more likely you were to fast. And some religious groups fasted really regularly, but not all of them did. And so people saw the differences between the two, and they're like, those people over there, they're fasting all the time. These people over here, they're not. And so some people brought this question to Jesus. What they really wanted to know is, who's more spiritual, the people who are fasting and the people who are not fasting? And if the people who are fasting are more spiritual, why don't the people who aren't fasting do it? Or the people who aren't fasting are more spiritual, why don't the people who are doing it stop, right? What they really wanted to know is, who's right and who's wrong? Who's more spiritual? Who's less spiritual? Those who fast or those who don't? And that's a question that you and I can identify with, because that's a question we probably have asked ourselves on a number of occasions over a bunch of different issues. Who's more spiritual? This people who do this or those people who don't do that? Those people who withdraw from society and live set apart, or those people who kind of immerse themselves in culture? Who's more spiritual, right? Who's more spiritual, the people who go to church once a week or the people who go to church every day? Who's more spiritual? Who's more spiritual, those who have, you know, dancing and ecstatic utterances in their worship, or those whose worship is more simple? Who's more spiritual? We want to know. What's right? What's wrong? What's better? What's worse? Who's spiritual? Who's not? So in Mark chapter 2, we have a series of five controversy stories about Jesus. Jesus is kind of butting heads with the spiritual leaders, the Jewish spiritual leaders. And so we already saw early on, Jesus forgave the paralyzed man. Remember the man whose friends let him down through the roof, the hole in the roof, tore up the guy's house, let their friend down. The first thing Jesus did was forgive the sins. Well, that's pretty controversial, because you can't go around forgiving other people's sins. And then the next, we saw him invite Matthew, this tax collector, to be one of his disciples, and he goes to Matthew's house, and he eats with Matthew and other tax collectors and sinners. I mean, we talked about what kind of sinners we're talking about there. And Jesus does those two things, and I mean, both of those are pot stirrers, right? Those are things that make him a really controversial figure. They demonstrate that Jesus is radically different than every other religious movement out there. And there were several religious movements out there, some of which were really good. Think about like John the Baptist. John the Baptist had his disciples. You got the Essenes, who some people believe John the Baptist came from. or lived among, because there were a lot of similarities between the Essenes. There were the Pharisees, very strict law keepers, right? There were the Sadducees. There were good things in many of these groups, some really spiritual, pursuing God type of things. But Jesus is different than all of those. And so in response to this really simple, it's kind of a simple question about fasting, Jesus opens up to the heart of the matter about how different Jesus is from everybody else and everything else. So if you have your Bibles, you want to follow along, it's from Mark chapter 2, beginning at verse 18. It's got really three short kind of parables, mini parables, so to speak. Now, John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. And some people came and asked Jesus, how is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours are not? Well, Jesus answered, how can the guests of the bridegroom, or possibly attendants there instead of guests, I mean, the word's the same, but the people who are at the wedding, how can they fast while he's with them? They can't. They cannot. So long as they have him with them. But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, and on that day they'll fast. No one sews a patch of unshrunken cloth on an old garment. Otherwise, the new piece will pull away from the old, making the tear worse. And no one pours new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the wine will burst the skins, and both the wine and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins. And I got to be honest here, it looks to me like Jesus is all over the map here, doesn't it to you? What does this have to do? I mean, I understand he asks about fasting and Jesus uses this parable about the wedding, and that sort of makes sense to me. Then he starts talking about clothes, then he starts talking about wine and wineskins. What is Jesus trying to say? I never have really understood why this is all sort of linked up here together. It doesn't really seem that they go together. Well, to begin, let's just start at the beginning, the very basic issue about fasting. Begin with a little background on fasting. Fasting didn't start here in the New Testament. It had been going on for a long time. Even the Jews weren't the only ones to practice fasting. But in Judaism, there was a history of fasting. We see, in fact, five different fasts from the Old Testament. The only one that was commanded by law, the only one that's written, if you go back to Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, that's in the law, it's in the Torah, is the Day of Atonement. And that was the day when Israel would bring their offerings to the priest, and the priest would sacrifice these animals on the altar and make atonement for their sins. This is what it says. It talks about this several times in the law, but here's kind of a brief summation from Leviticus 23:27. The 10th day of the 7th month is the Day of Atonement. Hold a sacred assembly and deny yourselves. Now, the phrase deny yourselves there is sometimes interpreted fast. It just means don't partake, right? Deny yourselves and present a food offering to the Lord. So this is the only fast that's in the law. But this is the very beginning of Judaism, right? By the end, by the time they're delivered from Babylonian captivity, hundreds of years later, Zechariah talks about at least four different fasts. In Zechariah 8:19, he talks about the fast in the 4th month, the 5th month, and the 10th month, well, the 7th month, which is this one, and the 10th month as well. So he mentions three others. And then in addition, you've got from the book of Esther, you've got the fast of Purim, where people would remember the time God delivered them from that situation. So there's at least five different fasts from the Old Testament. But this, what we're talking about today, is not any of those. Okay? They're not asking Jesus, why don't your disciples fast on the Day of Atonement? Or why don't they fast for Purim? Or why don't they fast for any of these other religious holy days? Right? We see Jesus and his disciples, they celebrate the Passover. We know that they participated in other of their religious holy days. So there's no evidence that they didn't participate fully, including in the fast for the Day of Atonement. This question wasn't about those fasts. This was a question about the regular fasts that the disciples of John and the disciples of the Pharisees. Now, disciples of the Pharisees, it's a strange phrase. It would be like saying a follower of the Republicans or a follower of the Democrats. You're not really a disciple of the Pharisees. You either are a Pharisee or you're not. But trying to, I think the phrasing that's used here in Mark is just saying, look, the followers here. So maybe they're talking about the younger people who are doing it, but more likely just means the Pharisees. So why is it that the Pharisees fast and the disciples of John fast on this regular basis? In fact, we know that they fasted twice a week. Twice a week. From sunup to sundown, they fasted on Mondays and Thursdays, the Pharisees did. And the disciples of John, they fasted regularly too, though we don't have documentation about that. We know that they fasted regularly, probably twice a week as well. But the reason they were fasting, well, they had a very specific reason. They're looking around at their world. They're looking around at what's wrong in Palestine, what's wrong with Israel. And they're like, we need deliverance, right? We are living under Roman occupation. The country is not as spiritual as it once was, and people aren't following the law, and this is just terrible. They're looking at the world around us, and you may do the same thing. You may look at our culture, and you're like, oh, you know, this is how terrible. And I've seen people bemoan all sorts of things that is wrong with our culture, and we need to fast and just fix this. God, fix this. We need deliverance. We need redemption. God, you've got to come and do something about this. So they're specifically mourning their situation, like mourning what once was and what ought to be again because it's gone, and they're praying for deliverance. And so that's what they were doing on twice a week from sunup to sundown. They were essentially petitions asking for God to do something about their circumstances. So why are those people doing that? Because they're really spiritual, obviously. And Jesus' disciples aren't doing that. And Jesus said his disciples aren't fasting because the bridegroom has come to the wedding. Now, you have to understand that a wedding celebration in Palestinian village life, this was like the greatest celebration that you can imagine. And everyone waits in joy and anticipation for the arrival of the bride and the groom. This is the highlight. I mean, this is a big, big deal. Whenever there's a wedding, everyone participates, and you make the best thing you can make, and it's days of celebration. It's a big deal. So when Jesus says that the bridegroom has arrived, what he means is that deliverance has come. The deliverance that everyone else is begging for and praying for and fasting for, that deliverance is here. It's here now, and we know that. We're not praying for God to send deliverance because we know the deliverance has come. Now is not the time to fast. Now is the time to celebrate. And by calling himself the bridegroom, this is a big deal. It sort of sneaks in under the radar right there. Jesus is setting himself apart from every other religious group. Now, it wasn't calling the Messiah a bridegroom was not in popular context. People didn't go around saying, oh, God, send the bridegroom. Not that sort of thing. But throughout the Old Testament, especially in the prophets, like in Ezekiel and Isaiah, God calls himself the bridegroom, and the coming of the bridegroom symbolized the coming of deliverance. So you get passages like this from Isaiah chapter 62, where God says, as a young man marries a young woman, so will your builder marry you. As a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you. God is the bridegroom, right? And the people in Isaiah, they're looking, they're staring down the barrel of exile. They're living in Babylonian exile at this point. And God says, don't worry, the bridegroom's coming. The bridegroom's coming. So Jesus and his disciples can't be like everyone else, because everyone else is praying for deliverance that Jesus and his disciples know is already here. This is a radical break from the status quo. It's so different that it's a whole new garment. It's a whole new batch of wine. Now, you've probably heard this explained before, but I'll do it because not everybody understands. If, like me, you are very schooled in the arts of cloth and tailoring and all that. You know that once you wash something, it shrinks, right? That's what keeps happening to my clothes. I keep washing them, they keep getting smaller and smaller, right around the waist. Right? You wash something and it shrinks. That's the way it works. So if you have something that's older and it's been washed and it's shrunk, and you get a hole in it and you want to patch it up, you can't put new cloth on it. Because if you put new cloth on there, then you wash it, then the new cloth shrinks and pulls away from the old cloth. It'll tear the old cloth when it shrinks in the wash, or when it just gets wet in the rain or something like that. Right? The new cloth will shrink and tear, make a bigger hole. Similarly, with wineskins, everybody, they would use these animal skins to store, like goat skins, to store wine. They would get them, and they clean them, they tan them, and then they would sew them up. And then you would put new wine in there. Well, you know how soft new leather is, right? So this new wine, you put it in there, it starts to ferment, and it expands. It sort of stretches the leather a little thin. It thins it out some. So you can do this a couple of times with new wine, but after a while, that leather starts to get hard and it's stretched thin. You can't put any more new wine in there because by this point, it's thin, it's hard, and it's fragile. So if you were to put new wine into an old wineskin, that new wine starts to ferment and expand. The old wineskin can't do that. It's hard, it's thin, and pop, and you lose the wineskin and you lose the wine both. So what Jesus is saying is, I'm so different than every other religious movement, than everything else you've ever known, that I cannot just adapt what we're doing to them. This is a new work, a new coming of God, a new creation. I am not here to put a patch on Judaism, which is what the disciples of John were, though they were praying for a deliverer to come, and Jesus was the deliverer. The Pharisees were like, we need to be better about keeping the law. We need to just fix this, right? It's like, we don't want a new car. We want you to fix the old car. We're going to take it to the repair shop. And that's essentially what their movement was about. Same thing with the Essenes. They were praying for God to fix broken Judaism. And Jesus says, I'm not a repair shop. I'm a dealership. Brand new. New clothing, new wine. And you can't just stick me in the old forms, right? What Jesus wasn't saying that fasting was bad or that fasting was invalid or that it didn't work or that his disciples weren't going to fast in the future. In fact, he says in the future they will fast. And we know that the earliest Christians did fast. And one of the earliest Christian documents outside of the New Testament, and it's even older, some believe even older than some of the books in the New Testament, it's called the Didache. Now, the Didache is like, it's a Christian rule book 101, just a really basic thing, and it made its way around in the early churches, and it's really short. You can sit down and read it in about 5-10 minutes, and it's just got some basic rules that kind of they expected all Christians throughout the churches to do, and some of those were about fasting. So if you were going to be baptized, you were supposed to fast for a day or two ahead of time. If you were going to baptize someone, you needed to fast a day or two ahead of time along with them, right? There was one of the rules in Didache 7:4. There's only like 3 or 4 rules per chapter. And in Didache 8:1, it says this, let not your fasts be with the hypocrites, for they fast on Mondays and Thursdays. Who fasts on Mondays and Thursdays? The Pharisees. That's right. So it said, do your fasts on Wednesdays and Fridays. So Christians, even in the first century, were fasting twice a week, but their fasts weren't anything at all like what all these other religious movements were doing. Their fasts had a different purpose. You know, fasting is a valid and powerful spiritual discipline, but we do so knowing that our Redeemer and our Deliverer has come and is with us. We don't fast for deliverance, we fast with our Deliverer. That's the difference. And like all spiritual disciplines, it cannot make you spiritual. Doing fasting does not make you spiritual any more than doing prayer or doing worship. And none of those things can make you spiritual. It's a tool. It's a tool like this hammer, right? I can use this hammer to improve my carpentry skills. Or more likely, I could use this hammer to knock myself out. Right? You can use a tool to get better. Fasting is just a helpful tool for earnest Christians Or it can be something, and this has happened too, it can be something that we make ourselves feel good about our spirituality. Look at me. I'm fasting, and those people back there are not. I know. I can tell. Because I've got the ash on my face, and I've got my hair unwashed, and I'm wearing these dirty old robes. I'm fasting. You back there, you got grease at the corner of your mouth. Right? So they would look at other people, the hypocrites, the Pharisees would do that, and they'd feel good about ourselves. And we as Christians can certainly do the same thing. We can look at it as a way to boast about how much more godly we are than those other people, just like the hypocrites. We can do the same thing with going to church. Look at me, I'm going to church. Not once a week, I go twice a week. Well, I don't go twice a week, I go three times a week. Y'all just go three times a week. Our church meets every day. Our church services last an hour. Ours last 2 hours. Our church services are really simple. Well, ours are simple plus more. They can all be good, but they're not a way to prop ourselves up. So when Jesus talks about fasting, this is what he says in the Sermon on the Mount. When you fast, do not look somber like the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others they're fasting. They would get this ash, rub it right here. You know how, like, you know, when you get really skinny, not from my pictures, but other people's, this kind of part right here, it hollows out. So you get a little ash, you rub it right there, and you rub it up under their eyes to make it look how much weight I've lost. That's what the Pharisees would do. Jesus said, truly, they've received their reward in full. They get the recognition for being godly. But when you fast, put oil in your head and wash your face. In other words, clean up. So that it won't be obvious to others that you're fasting, but only to your Father, who is unseen. And your Father, who sees what's done in secret, will reward you. The purpose of fasting is not to feel better about yourselves in relation to others. It's about drawing closer to God. That's all it's about. Same thing with prayer. We can stand up here and you can, when you get leave here today and you say, you know, look, prayer is a great thing. So you go down to the local Mexican restaurant, and it's time for your meal to be there, and you stand up, and you throw your hands over your head. Lord, thank you for the chips and the salsa, and you can really go all out, right, and draw attention to yourself. I know I could. I'm thankful for chips and salsa. Or you can just quietly bow and tell God thanks for his good gifts, right? It's all about how you use these tools, about how you use them to draw closer to God. So fasting itself is not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It can be a helpful thing. And if you have questions about that, I'd be happy to sit down and talk with you about that. But this morning, we want to talk about, really quickly, the difference between Jesus and everything else. About this time of year, everybody decides that they need to make some changes in their lives. How many of you did resolutions? Real quick, just raise your hand. I'm not going to ask what they are. Raise your hand if you did resolutions. What a bunch of slackers you are. You're like, no, I'm good. Pretty much got it nailed. Yeah, alive. All right, I guess we're done. No, a lot of people around this time of year, they want to say, look, I need to do things better. I need to make some improvements in my life. I need to stop doing this, start doing that. Those sorts of things, and those are good. And sometimes we can treat Christianity like that. Like, say, I pretty much got it together, but what I need Jesus for is just these little parts here and there. And Jesus refuses to be the patch. He refuses to be just a little more. You cannot add Jesus to your existing life or patch your existing life with Jesus. That is not what he came to do. Jesus did not come to fix your existing life. He came to give you a new life. That's how radically different he is. Jesus did not come so that you'd somehow magically get better at finances and relationships. Jesus came so that you would completely be a different person who has a different way of thinking about finances and a different way of thinking about relationships and a different way of thinking about your place in this world and the way you do and say and think. It's a whole new ball game. Jesus refuses to be the Sunday morning fix. He's a Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, Sunday night, all Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, all week long and weekend too. That's what he is. And you cannot short sell the role of Christ in your life. You cannot apply him over here to your morals, but not apply him over here to the way you show grace to others. You cannot apply Jesus when it comes to, I'm going to keep the rules here, and not apply him over here when it comes to your generosity. It's all or nothing. So Christ has come not just to fix you, but that so that, like Ray talked about this morning, so that you might be in him, become him, be Christ to the world. And this morning, if we can pray for you, encourage you, strengthen you, forgiveness, if you're ready to become a child of God, we want you to know, we want to help you in any way we can. So won't you come as we stand and as we sing.